You're listening to Mom and Doc Talk, where we talk all things healing pans and pandas with an emphasis on homeopathy.
Hi, I'm Jody, the mom.
And I'm Dr. Bar, the doc, and welcome to Mom and Doc Talk, where we are joined today by Dr. Anju Usman Singh. I'm really excited to have her here. She is a colleague through the Medical Academy for Pediatric Special Needs, and I just really adore her because of the expertise she brings, the humor, the lightheartedness, just the heart that she brings to all of our meetings with MAPS. And I also love that she's somebody who loves homeopathy. So we are here to talk about really what we're going to talk about is the crossover and the overlap between autism and PANS pandas. So before we dive into all of that, I want to just tell you a little bit about Dr. Singh or Dr. Usman Singh. So Dr. Anju Usman Singh is director and owner of True Health Medical Center and Pure Compounding Pharmacy in Naperville, Illinois. She serves as chief science officer for family-owned nutraceutical company, True Healing Naturals. She specializes in biomedical interventions for children with ADD, autism, PANS pandas, Down syndrome, and related disorders. She's been involved in research regarding copper and zinc imbalances, metallothionine dysfunction, biofilm-related infections, and hyperbaric oxygen therapy. Dr. Usman Singh serves on the medical advisory boards for Documenting Hope, TACA, the Autism Community in Action, and Autism Hope Alliance, AHA. She is on the faculty for MAPS, the Medical Academy for Pediatric and Special Needs. Dr. Usman Singh received her medical degree from Indiana University and completed a residency in family practice at Cook County Hospital in Chicago, Illinois. She is board certified in family practice and holds a certification in homeopathy and integrative medicine. Welcome, Dr. Usman Singh. We're so excited to have you here.
I'm so excited to be here talking to you guys too.
Well, you already shared a lot about yourself in your bio, but tell us just a little bit more about yourself and how you got first interested in functional and integrative medicine.
Well, I want to start by saying I love the name of your podcast, the Mom and Doc thing, because I kind of feel like that's who I am, like in one, you know, like the moms have like that doctor personality going on, and then the doctors have the mom piece going on too. And I think us doctor moms, my license plate for my car is Doc Mama.
I love
it. So, and I have four kids. So I'm in this journey. I feel like I always tell my moms, I call you guys my moms. I always tell my moms, like, we're in that same boat together. We are just trying to figure this stuff out together. And I started in 1991 after my daughter was born. She had a lot of food allergies and asthma and peanut allergies. And then my other one had type 1 diabetes and asthma and allergies. And then my other one had chemical sensitivities. And so, you know, it's been a long haul trying to figure my kids out. In the process, I learned a lot from my patients and my children.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's how I got started. I started doing research. I started working at a clinic called the Pfeiffer Treatment Center. I don't know if you guys know about Carl Pfeiffer, but he started this concept of orthomolecular medicine in the 1970s, and that was like using things like B6 and magnesium for schizophrenia and using things like zinc for ADD. And he had these protocols, and then that went through an offshoot. Then I started speaking at like the DAN conferences in the early 2000s, Defeat Autism Now, and was involved in the think tank there. And I just learned a whole lot. And, you know, all of us just keep evolving.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about how you got interested in working with kids on the spectrum and PANS.
Yeah, so that came by serendipitously too, because I was working at the Pfeiffer Center, and Dr. Walsh and I were doing research on copper zinc imbalances in children with autism. And we studied hundreds of kids, and we presented a paper to the American Psychiatric Association, which showed that 99% of our kids on the spectrum had high copper and low zinc. And we ratio that copper and zinc like a copper serum to a zinc plasma, and that ratio should be 1 to 1. So it's usually like 100 to 100. And what we found is that patients with high copper had more ADD type symptoms. And so I got kind of like, you know, I went to conferences, I talked about copper zinc, and then Dr. Pfeiffer and Dr. Walsh also talked a lot about methylation. And in the 80s, they had this concept of over-methylation and under-methylation. And so I talked a lot about, you know, over and under methylation. And now with genomics, we're able to kind of like pinpoint, you know, where these blocks are on our methylation pathways. And it's a little bit more, I think, more scientific on how we approach it now, but even just that concept. And so I started, you know, researching that, working with that, and of course, seeing a lot of patients with autism. And then as it, you know, like with these types of epidemics that we're seeing, the PANS kids, the PANDAS kids just started, you know, I think in the 2000s, we started seeing these kids where we would get that history with autism of the regression, you know, at 15 to 18 months. Mm-hmm. And then we'd get, before when I started doing this, you know, the kids would just kind of get better, like boom, boom, boom. They would get better, and we wouldn't have these episodes of what I call these flares, mm-hmm. because this regression occurs when you're healthy, and then now this new state happens that you're unhealthy. But these flares occur in an unhealthy state, and then you have an acute change that, you know, is a negative change in your behavior or your medical condition. And so these flares, I started seeing them. And Dr. Suedo, who came up with the term PANDAS and PANS, and who came up with the research and is the big driving force behind this whole research behind PANDAS, Dr. Suedo came to one of our think tanks and early on. And so we got to get information about PANDAS very early on. And we're cognizant.
Yes, you were like in the vanguard. So PANDAS and PANS has been in your world for like, you know, 20, nearly 20 years. Or over 20 years, like 25 years now, right? 25, 26 years?
Well, 20 years, because she started talking about it, like really talking about it in like 98, 99, uh-huh. like 2000. And I started in with Dan like 2000. And then mm-hmm. So we really started, you know, 2005, 2006, she started really talking to us about it.
Yeah.
And she was great. Open to coming to the DAN conferences and all of that. And she's been to MAPS, and Dr. Cunningham has been to MAPS as well. So, mm-hmm. You know, we've heard it firsthand from them.
Yeah.
It's a huge problem.
Well, I'm curious because, you know, you've had experience with it from early, like when it was first, you know, like early stages of being defined and early stages of being recognized, like even in the, you know, I've been working with PANS for about a decade now, maybe a little bit longer than a decade. I don't even remember. But like, even in the time I've been working with it, I'm just seeing like the recognition of it explode. And like the cases of it are just like, so surprising with how much is coming out about this. So I'm curious if you have any thoughts about why the conditions resulting from impaired immune responses have become so much more prevalent in the last like decade or so.
You know, that's a $1 million question. We could all like sit here and like
theorize about it,
hash it all out. Like, what is going on? You know, we always use that kind of statement, there's no such thing as a genetic epidemic.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, now with PANS and PANDAS, it's so common. It's almost like, you know, developmental delays in 1 in 10 of our kids. And then PANS, PANDAS on top of that, it's, you know, I forget the exact statistics, but
the last one I saw was 1 in 200, but that might be really old at this point.
Yeah. Yeah. That sounds about right. Yeah. So why is it more common? I mean, I'm going to shoot that back to you guys. What do you think? Because I have my ideas. Because you have your own experience and yeah. I have mine. So
I mean, I think there's environmental changes that are happening, right? And things that are I mean, the reality is like, we've always had environmental toxins, right? So like whenever we just talk about like the toxicity of our environment, I'm like, okay, but you know, was PANS really prominent when people were like literally like just dumping their sewage in the streets and like coal, breathing in, you know, coal burning stuff everywhere? I don't think that we had PANS as prevalent back then. I don't know, but also maybe we did and it wasn't documented. I mean, as I'm preparing for this talk about complex chronic illness that I'm going to be giving soon, I'm reading through all the, like, you know, hundreds of years old literature about, you know, understanding complex illness and homeopathy. And I see all these places where I'm like, well, there's somebody talking about PANS here. Somebody's talking about PANS here. So, I mean, I think it's existed. And I think we're just, so I think that we're finding new things to be reactive to that we probably would have been reactive to other things. And I think that, I think we've got more stressors in our life than we used to. More constant demands on ourselves than we used to. So I think that we're just all more sensitive in general because we're all like fried, right? And I think that right. There's also a recognition component. Like, I mean, how many people, myself included, and Jody is included as well, that never would have been diagnosed with PANS, but now, like looking back in retrospect, meet all of the criteria for it. So just having a definition for it and understanding, and how many people got diagnosed with like a mental health condition or something else that was ultimately PANS and like an immune function issue.
Yeah. And I do think there's that whole, like, okay, so I think like my two daughters had PANS flares and episodes that we didn't even have a name for it then. And I would be like, what is going on with, you know, why are there so much more OCD and anxiety and separation anxiety? And I didn't even recognize it. I just thought they were just being bad.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what the schools think about the kids when they're flaring, that like, oh, they're not paying attention or they're just being bad kids. And I do think there's that component, like you said. So definitely, I think more awareness. I think, like you also mentioned, that we're more sensitive.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, to me, is a big problem. Like it used to be when we were studying toxicology, mm-hmm. the toxicologist would say the dose makes the poison.
Yep.
But I totally disagree with that because I have a daughter who passed away from a peanut allergy. Now, how does a peanut kill you? You know, how does it do that? How does your immune system overreact that much to a little peanut? That's not a big, you know, it's not a big dose of a toxin.
Yeah.
And I have a daughter with multiple chemical sensitivities and it's parts per trillion. Like if she goes by somebody with a little nail polish and hairspray, I mean, she's on the couch for a week.
Yeah.
So, you know, why are our kids so sensitive? And I think it's, again, you said it, it's all these stressors that EMFs, the way our houses are made and we're stuck inside breathing mold toxins. And I think, you know, it's just putting a burden on our system. But I think with PANDAS, I really think, like, you know, antibiotics play a huge role in these bugs becoming like super bugs. And it's potentially, you know, even vaccinations causing bugs to become super bugs.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, we're creating this individual where, okay, we're protecting them against this particular bug, but then the bug's like, hey, I have to figure out a way to stay alive.
Right.
And so they become resistant. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've been trying to think about this a lot because, you know, we've got kids, it's you know, PANDAS strep, right? Mm-hmm. And then the PANS with the mycoplasma and Lyme, and then we've got Bartonella and Babesia, and we've got these viruses that are activating the immune system, and COVID now. And I'm thinking, why don't the kids get rid of these things? Like, why can't they just recognize it and deal with it?
Yeah.
And you know, we're having to chase them with these antibiotics, which I hate because it. Mm-hmm. So it's a, you know, it's a conundrum.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Nobody has an answer to your question, I think.
Yeah, no, I know, right? Like, I mean, that's why it's good to have like these theoretical conversations and like, you know, just throwing things around. I mean, I think that it's all of those things. I mean, like, I know Jody's just dying to come back to talking about susceptibility, and I'll let you get there in a second, Jody.
There you go.
Fine.
But I think that I mean, we also have to just acknowledge that, like, we do, like, there's long-standing susceptibility, because PANS is not new. It didn't get discovered. It didn't start in 1998. Like I said, I'm reading cases and documents about things that are like literally written in the 1700s, 1800s, and there's clearly cases of PANS that I'm reading, right?
Oh, I totally agree. I even think, like, some of these mental illnesses, like you mentioned, like schizophrenia, there's a component of that for, like, parasitic infections triggering it.
Yep.
So,
absolutely.
You know, like, what is our true definition of what mental illness is?
Right. No, I personally think that someday we're going to have. Yeah, I think that psychiatry is going to recognize that it always belonged as this, like, subset of immunology, that, like, really everything psychiatry is just immunology, is, I think, where we're going to end up going. But we're like throwing things too, or like, we're just to add to the soup with, like, you know, the information that we have on things like genomics, that we're now realizing that we have been accidentally poisoning ourselves with synthetic nutrients, and, like, stripping the like appropriate nutrients out and replacing them in our foods with synthetics, and then gumming up our genetic works. So we're taking kids who maybe their susceptibility wouldn't have been so high if we didn't have all of these things, if they weren't inside all the time, having the stressors of, like, the life that we have set up now, not getting sunshine, not getting exercise, eating fortified foods, you know, exposed to all of these all these chemicals that are trying to kill the mold, who's then fighting back against the chemicals we're using. And so, like, everything, like you said, is in a battle for survival, and it's being waged in our bodies in a lot of ways.
Yeah. It feels so much to me like burden, like, our babies' buckets are so full because of all of the things. And, you know, also it seems like the further we go along, for whatever reason it might be, from the food we eat to, you know, what's coming into our bodies and all of those things, that susceptibility just seems to get greater and greater as we go along. And also, I think it's lovely now that we know about, like, you guys know about susceptibility, but us moms didn't know what susceptibility was at all. Like, coming in to the PANS world, there was, like, everybody was, I don't even think people were talking about, like, root cause anything whenever we came into it. And I just think, like, hindsight from watching Avery's journey, you know, all of the things that happened that brought her to the place where PANS was triggered. There were a whole lot of different things. And it seems like those whole lot of different things are happening to a whole lot of kids. And it's like, as moms, we are just constantly scooping water out of the bucket to try and survive. And it's, I don't know, it seems like so many more moms are over there scooping water, trying to keep up with this thing, and then eventually their kid just goes over. That's my, like, how my brain makes sense of it.
Yeah, we used to hear that history, you know, at first it was the C-section or early antibiotics, mm-hmm. and then the ear infections, and then, you know, the other stressors from outside, and then eczema or asthma. And then the system would just fall down, you know.
Yeah. Well, you know, Dr. Swensing, I would love to, like, take a big sidestep and talk all about homeopathy and learn how you got into homeopathy and geek out with you on that. But the reason we invited you here, I want to make sure we talk about this, because I know there's a lot of parents who are dying to hear your feedback on, like, really sort of differentiating and how you look at things with autism and PANS, or overlap of all of that. So let's dive into there. And if we've got time, I might see if we can geek out a little bit about homeopathy and learn more about your experience with that. So I'm curious if you can share with us what your experience is for, like, you know, the overlap that can happen with PANS and ASD, and, like, what signs you really look for to suggest that it's more likely one versus the other. Because I know in my practice, I've seen it go both ways, right? I've seen parents come in who have an autism diagnosis, but then we figure out that it's actually PANS. We address it as if it's PANS, and the autism diagnosis goes away. And then I've had the other where parents are certain that they've got PANS and it's clearly just autism. And then I've of course seen it overlap with both. So with your, you know, years of expertise in it, what do you look at? What are your thoughts?
So the history is key to this, because PANS is a diagnosis not based on any laboratory testing. It's all based on history. And so this history of regression is to me like the key point. So we're doing okay, we're doing okay, we're doing okay. And then we have this like fall off the curve and that acute change in behavior. So most of our patients with autism, they may have been misdiagnosed early on with autism instead of PANS because they didn't get that history. Oh, they are having these infections, and then they had these regressions, and they had an infection, they had this regression, and they had this infection, and then pretty soon they're stuck with this chronic autoimmune encephalitis, and we're not going up and down anymore. We're just flatline now with our OCD, our anxiety, tics, sensory issues, enuresis, academics, processing,
all the things,
all of that. So if I get that history where we're doing okay, something happens, we get sick, we travel, we move into a moldy house, and then we have this regression, and then we have the diagnosis of autism, and then we're doing okay, and then a virus comes along or a strep infection comes along, and all of a sudden the mom and dad say, something happened to my kid. And Sue Suedo says it's a lightning strike. It's like that acute, where one day we're okay and one day we're not okay. I don't think it's that clear, but that's how she puts it. And then she also talks about the roller coaster, where, you can recover after those infections the first time. And I kind of think of it almost like an allergic reaction. The first time you have it, it's not so bad. The second time it's a little worse. The third time it's a little worse. The fourth, it just kind of gets worse and worse and worse. Your immune system's reaction to this, virus or infection that the immune system is intolerant of and cannot handle. Mm-hmm. And so, as you guys know, the body starts to fight that infection, and then ends up fighting itself. So it's an autoimmune condition based on antibodies in dopamine receptors, tubulin, gangliocyte, and it affects a certain part of the brain. Mm-hmm. Where autism is more of like a generalized issue, PANDAS is much more specific to these infections that are triggering these changes in behavior. And so, again, if I get more of a stagnant history where I had this regression, I'm pretty stable, but, I still have social issues, behavioral issues, language issues, I'm saying, that's pretty much our classic autism.
Yeah.
And then we have those where we had that diagnosis of autism, and then we're having these regressions, and we're not able to stabilize our child, they're not able to be stable at all. And they're just up and down and up and down. And those are the kids I really worry. There's something that's triggering their immune system and they just can't stabilize. Mm-hmm. And most of the time it's either mast cell activation.
Mm-hmm.
And those kids flare, like this morning they're flaring, this afternoon they're flaring. It's not like they get infection and they're flaring for 2 or 3 weeks or six weeks. It's just this boom, boom, boom. And this moms will come in and they'll say, oh, I think my kid has PANS. And, they flared this morning and, 2 days ago, something happened. And I said, that's more mast cell. That's not, our classic PANS flares.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, again, those kids who are just up and down and up and down like this. And then I have those kids who had that history of these infections. We never recognized it because mm-hmm. they're so severe in their autism. Mm-hmm. That you can't even see these changes happening. Mm-hmm. Like they're always OCD and they always have anxiety and they're just stimping away. And it's subtle, but there might be some up and downs. But those are we would call those kids more classic autoimmune encephalitis,
mm-hmm.
where it just becomes more stagnant and inflamed mm-hmm. all the time. And I treat those kids more like PANDAS kids too, but you're not seeing that roller coaster ride.
Yeah. How often are you seeing someone who is diagnosed with ASD actually end up having PANS?
It's pretty common. And I wish I, had statistics to share with you. But sometimes I'll sit here with a history and we'll talk about it. And I said, you know, that was an infection. And then now we've got this diagnosis. To guess, I'd say about 1 out of 10. It's pretty common. And it's pretty common to have the co diagnoses. And I also see it's really common comorbid type of stuff with Down syndrome. Mm-hmm. Autism, Down syndrome, PANS and PANDAS, and they're not being able to sift out that, you know, my child actually has 3 diagnoses.
Yeah. This is where it can just get so complicated because it can really, 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 really overlap. Like you're saying, if you've got early signs of autism, you can have PANS show up and it might not even be clear that it's showing up depending on the severity. And then there's also the reality is so much of PANS can have ways that you explain away, like developmentally appropriate, that they're transient, and how much of it was transient and how much of it was actually immune mediated, and how much of it was actually like behavioral or like playing around with something as you're like getting a new neurological synapse forming. And so it can just get really, really messy, right? Because then you can also have a warning sign for me, I don't know about for you, is if they're getting a late autism diagnosis. I'm really curious if it was PANS. Because, if they're like older and they're saying, oh, we think your kid has autism, it's just like, Are you sure this just hasn't reached the point that we're more in steady state PANS, because the body just can't like drop back down into like the between flare states, or the between flare states are still pretty flary, you know?
Yeah. I had one kid who was just diagnosed at like 7, and they diagnosed him with autism, and I couldn't even diagnose him with PANS because he just did not have the history, but this acute regression, and it was all autoimmune stuff. Mm-hmm. Colitis, encephalitis, just a lot of autoimmune stuff. And again, you know, it's these similar types of triggers probably, but we just can't call it PANS.
Yeah.
And even with autism, you know, like you said, all mental illness is probably going to be immunology.
Yeah.
But there's such a, like a cross reaction with the immune system. Like Th17 is the big one for PANDAS. Mm-hmm. So Th17, you know, the body fights the infection. It migrates up the nose. It hits the basal ganglia, and it stimulates this OCD and anxiety. And Th17 is also associated with a lot of the colitis, enteritis mm-hmm. that Dr. Krigsman's seeing, you know, with the kids that he scopes that are on the spectrum.
Yeah, so, I have to say, Dr. Usman's thing, I'm just like, every time I listen to anybody who does like the integrative stuff and the functional stuff, like on a daily basis, I am so impressed, because I feel like, I mean, homeopathy is not an easy thing to do. You got to know a lot about a lot of things, but like, I'm just lazy. I just want to give a remedy. And like, because trying to sort through all of these things, I'm like, well, we can take all these things together. We need to understand all the nuances about what's going on. And we're still just going to give a remedy that matches the symptoms, that it's going to help us know how to manage it. So that's one thing I love about, you know, just having a homeopathy as a tool for all of these super complex cases. Cause like you said, we've got so many kids that we see at Resilience that are like Down syndrome and MCAS and PANS, and like just so much overlap. And I don't know, I get overwhelmed thinking about all of the things. I feel like, you know, it's swirling around in my brain.
Overwhelmed like that. And I know the parents must get overwhelmed too with us, you know, talking to them about, you know, mitochondria and methylation and, you know, and all the immune stuff. And that's why I love homeopathy, because sometimes I tell the parents, you know what, it doesn't even matter what the diagnosis is. Like, what difference does it make? It doesn't matter what the diagnosis is. We have to figure out how to treat your child and figure out how to calm down their immune system. To me, from a non-homeopathic perspective, it's the toxicity load that you talked about. Like, what's triggering the immune system? Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have these infections, but why do we have these infections? Why is the immune system so bad? Yeah. So then you keep going backwards, and I'm like, it still breaks down to clean up your environment, mm-hmm. clean up your diet, clean up your gut,
mm-hmm.
work on detox.
Yeah.
And, you know, get your body's emunctories open, or whatever terminology you want to use, and and see if you can balance them out with a little homeopathy. And I don't know. I mean, I think that works the best. Sometimes I say, you know, I'm using these diagnoses for a framework for me.
Yes. Yeah.
It helps me with the framework, but if I get caught up in it all, I drive myself.
You can tunnel it, right? Like, all right, well, let's go ahead and do a quick diversion then, because we just keep coming back to it. Because susceptibility is like, ultimately, like I tell some people sometimes, I was talking about it with my team the other day, that with homeopathy and like really understanding, like getting to like the core, it's like a toddler. Like I have a 4-year-old right now, or almost 4-year-old. It's like, why? Like we have to be like a toddler. Well, why are they having these symptoms? Well, because they're toxic. Well, why are they toxic? Because of, you know, exposure to this thing. But why are they having this reaction to the strep or the mold or whatever? Because not everybody has the same reaction to it. It's about your unique individual susceptibility. So I am going to go ahead and let us have a diversion. I just want to know, how did you get first introduced to homeopathy?
Oh, wow. That's really interesting. I'm trying to, it was by accident. I was working at a clinic, a family practice clinic, and they decided that they were going to shut it down, but I had like $5,000 in CME to spend. So I took that a week long course at the Center for Homeopathy, you know, in Virginia and or Washington, D.C., and I just dove into it. I just thought, okay, that's something I don't know about. And I loved it. And that introduced me to the Pfeiffer Treatment Center, because I came back and I met some homeopaths in our area, and they said, oh, you should look here. You should look there. So homeopathy actually got me into biomed.
Interesting. Usually people go the other direction. Like,
I'm not that good of a homeopath, so I couldn't do it. It's hard.
It is hard.
It's very hard.
Had you had any introduction to homeopathy before, or you're just like,
no? I know, people look at me and they're like, where are you from? I say Indiana. Yeah, that's where I'm from.
Yeah.
Indiana. And so I was not introduced to homeopathy. Cornfields in my back.
It's just, that's why, I mean, the reason I'm just surprised that you had like no introduction to it, that you were interested in like exploring it, because most people who start off with allopathic medicine, it is not generally like, okay, let me find out about homeopathy.
Well, yeah, it was, you know, it was my kids. So my daughter, Priya, I talk a lot about her, but you know, she's struggling with her asthma and her allergies, and I'm trying to figure out what can I do. So I learned about homeopathy. I learned about Chinese medicine. I learned about chiropractic, craniosacral, NAET, I mean, Bioset, low-dose immunotherapy, everything I could think of.
So it really does go back to the beginning where
lasers, red lights, ion cleanse. I mean, the whole thing.
All of the things. You know, I have to say, I love that what really binds all of us together is our daughters. And like, you know, you found homeopathy, both of you found homeopathy for your daughters and through like the challenges your daughters were facing. And I found homeopathy in the hopes that my daughter could exist someday. So I just think that's beautiful.
I'm so happy she exists because of homeopathy.
All right, let's get back to these questions that we know our moms are dying to get some answers to.
I know. I was about to say, I'm going to take us backwards to what you guys were talking about before, how you got into homeopathy. And it's such a sticking point for us as moms, because we, for some reason, we need to know the difference. And I think it's so confusing, you know, having, you know, my daughter, her onset was 5 and she was 100% normal before that, and going to a neurologist and the neurologist telling me, you know, you just need to settle in with the fact that she's going to have an ASD diagnosis. And it's like, but there, and I had no understanding of any of this at the time. But it's like, wait, what? And then I have people telling me, no, well, this is a doctor. You need to listen to the doctor. It's hard to know who to listen to. But for some reason, we need a definite answer between the two of them. And going back to, that's what I love about homeopathy, is there doesn't have to be a definite answer, but you know, what the diagnosis is. But I am curious, whenever you're working with someone that has ASD and they develop PANS, does that change what you're doing treatment-wise with them?
Yeah, of course, because we have to work on more of the immune activation piece and get the immune system to try to balance out or to calm down. And sometimes I'll go back to some of my core concepts that I work with autism. And one of the big ones is the immune system. 70% of the immune system is in the gut. So the overlap for me with the two groups is, for both of them, I really like to work on gut health and making sure that the things in the microbiome are balanced and there's not a lot of dysbiosis. Because if we don't have enough lactobacillus or bifido, we're not going to stimulate those GABA receptors and that glutamate is going to take over. And then we're going to have more OCD and anxiety and more inflammation. So I think for that piece, you know, I always have that kind of piece in my like protocols. I always have like a gut piece. And then with the autism kids, sometimes I will go there starting, you know, early on with detox. But if I try to detox a kid who's inflamed and immune activated, I'm going to be pushing more stuff into the immune system. And where does that come from? That comes from the body, into the liver, into the gallbladder, into the gut. And then everything gets flared again. And, you know, sometimes I'll see protocols where the child is flaring, they're very stimmy, they're very OCD, they're aggressive. And people are being thrown like chelators and glutathione and a bunch of methylation support. And I'm like, you know what? Just back off. Except, you know, if the house is burning, you gotta throw water on it. You gotta calm down that inflammation first. Sometimes inflammation is so strong and there's these toxins that are constantly pushing it. So you do have to go there, but if you haven't gone there, I definitely think like working on that inflammatory piece, just try kind of maybe shifting the way I focus, you know, immune, gut on top, and then mito, methylation, detox at the bottom for my PANS patients.
So I know that since you take a different approach and you're using more of like the functional biomedical approach, and you use homeopathy sometimes, or you work in, you know, collaborating with somebody who uses homeopathy to manage, you know, different aspects of the case. I'm curious if you see a similar pattern that I see with like just the homeopathic perspective, where if we've got a kiddo who has PANS and ASD, we typically see them have a slower response. It's like more slow and steady improvement versus like rapid changes. So like it's almost like the healing patterns look similar to the condition patterns. Do you see the same thing in the approaches that you use?
Yeah, I would say like with the multiple diagnosis, when you have like multiple layers of these different medical issues, then from my perspective, you know, the healing. And I'm looking at it a little differently, you know, when I'm giving a remedy versus, you know, a 3-month protocol,
right,
to see if things are moving. You know, I do want to see like with gut, I feel like I can shift gut health pretty quickly within weeks or months. But some of that like really like those mental symptoms, like the anxiety, the OCD, those take a lot longer to shift with the combo. With ASD and PANS, and then if you throw in something like Down syndrome on top of that even like pushes it out even further.
Yeah, I agree.
Definitely. I feel like there are a whole lot of moms that if they could ask you specific questions, there's this list of questions that they would have for you, because all of us are literally, we talk to moms every single day that are in this kind of like figuring it out. you know, what is what and what to call it and who to believe and all of the things. So mom specific questions, is it normal to see an immune component with ASD? Like, can their ASD specific symptoms get worse during illnesses?
Yes, because a lot of ASD is associated with microglial activation. So that's a fancy word for the immune system and the brain getting turned on. And microglial activation stimulates mast cell activation. So when they get sick, they can flare. But the severity of it and the length of how long it lasts, you know, they kind of like you and I, when we get sick, it's, we don't feel great. You know, our body aches, we're not sleeping, we don't feel hungry, you know, all of that. But when you take it to another level of escalating aggression, OCD, anxiety, then again, the PANS piece comes into play where the activation is more specific to this particular place in the brain. And more specific to this specific immune model.
We've talked about some concepts in homeopathy with like when acute illnesses can come in and like combine with the chronic state, and when acute illnesses can come in and sort of suppress the chronic state. Because we've seen some cases in autism too, where like in autism and in PANS, I see it more commonly in autism than in PANS. I'm curious if you see the same pattern where they'll get acutely ill, and I see more typically in autism that it calms them down and it's like they're the best that they've been when they're acutely ill. Whereas like PANS, typically they're acutely ill and they're flaring. So that, to me, that's a difference. It's not 100% because nothing in health is 100%, right? But I'm just wondering if you see a lot of that too, because like the suppression.
And I would throw fever into that. Because another thing is the fever response is a normal response. And if they have a fever, I rarely see them have a fever with PANS.
Right.
They don't have a normal immune response. So they don't get a sore throat. They don't have swollen lymph nodes. They don't get that rubor, tumor, calor, you know, they don't get those typical symptoms of how our immune system is supposed to behave. And the kids who get the fever actually get better illness. Because I think they have more of that normal immune response to the virus. And we're finding certain genomics associated with, okay, my immune response isn't great with viruses, or my immune response isn't great with, you know, bacteria, and my immune response and my toll-like receptors are different. Maybe susceptibility is different to those things. Yeah. But I love how you think, because, you know, I'm not used to thinking about things the way you guys do sometimes. And this whole kind of idea of like, okay, how long does it take and what's the response? And no, I think that's a really good, that's an interesting way of defining the two. That, yes, you're going to have a little bit of regression, but, you know, if we have a fever and we're feeling better overall, then that's not PANS.
Yeah. We actually see the same pattern that you were talking about. Like, we agree, most people with PANS don't have fevers. It's not true at all, but most of them don't have fever. So in our community, we celebrate the heck out of a fever, because, you know, homeopathy, when it addresses the susceptibility, it can help restore the appropriate immune function. And so like when we see typical immune function instead of neuropsychiatric symptoms, we are like, hallelujah. We are so excited to see the fevers. And of course, you know, the body will tend to over respond. And then we have lots of fevers and lots of illness, because the body's like, oh, I'm finally doing this right. Let me show off. And then it sort of settles down where it's not getting sick all the time anymore. But I digress. Wow. I know we got more mom questions.
Wow. A lot of people don't understand that. I wish more people would understand that. Yeah. And the whole idea of Tylenol, it's just,
No,
I do have like a PANS flare protocol, and I do use ibuprofen, but I usually tell the families, you know, if they're acutely ill and they have a fever, let them brew for a while before you go there with anything like that.
Yeah,
for sure. Is it common to see a regression from time to time in ASD?
Yeah, but I think like we said, these regressions aren't severe, and they aren't persistent. You know, I'll have a patient who flared in October, and that they're still in that state of severe OCD and anxiety. And so, again, to me, that is more PANS than up and down with the autism, where my OCD is a little worse, my OCD is a little bit better, my anxiety is a little worse, my anxiety is a little bit better. So it really has to do with these extremes. And I think the extremes in these behaviors are, you know, pretty evident, because they're hard to deal with.
Yeah. And I would add in that like we talked about before, that the regressions that are happening later in life, I think are less likely to be autism related, more likely to be PANS related. Would you agree? Yeah, so like the eight-year-old who suddenly can't read and do math, but was doing fine before, that's probably not going to be an autism type of regression, because it's bigger and more pronounced and later in life.
Yeah. And when Dr. Slato first started talking about this, she was talking about adolescents in particular with PANS. And I don't think it's just adolescents. I really think that pre-adolescence is where I see a lot of it. It's like that pre-puberty, when the hormones start, and that affects the immune system enough where we're getting a lot of these shifts. And then she also talked about how after adolescence, the disease should go away. And in some of our cases, we're seeing like flaring later on that looks like PANDAS. We can't call it that because it's a pediatric condition. So I think the moms and the parents, you know, obviously there's confusion. Even the doctors, I mean, some doctors say, I don't believe in it, right? Like they say, I don't believe in it. I'm like, not to believe in. I think what they don't believe is in, you know, how it's diagnosed, how it's treated. But we can agree that there are these conditions that are immune activated, and there's a change in behavior. There's a change in the health of the individual, and it happens acutely after infections. Now, what do we call it all?
I wish it was as simple as just saying that we can agree that this happens. Like, I wish that we could see the same things happening in front of us and call it the same thing, instead of calling it a mental health condition, or calling it a mental health condition in the mother, you know, like how often does that happen?
Overly protective. Even I had that same happen with me. My daughter was reacting to peanuts, and I asked them to keep her safe at school, and they said that they couldn't do that, that they couldn't risk other people's freedom. And this was in the early 90s, and now it's so common. So I know, like, you guys might see that there hasn't been an evolution, but I've seen the evolution in mothers being more aware of their bodies and taking care of themselves for pre-pregnancy, because they don't want to bring that toxic load into their children. But again, when I was in residency, and I'm like, you know, with doctors, and I'm at Cook County Hospital, never seeing the sun for 9 months, or not eating healthy, or not taking prenatals, or not getting vitamin D, nobody said, oh, maybe you should get some sunlight. So I do feel like now, like, there's a little bit, there's more awareness and more cognition, but there are definitely more affected kids, more sick kids.
Right. Yeah. I have to pause and say this is what I appreciate about doctors like you guys, because y'all are taking this experience, and I've only been in it like 7-8 years. But the change that I've seen since I've been in it, like, I feel like a trail is being blazed by fierce mamas. And we have this handful of providers that for whatever reason have this experience sort of in this world, or in just the chronic illness world, that are helping us like run this sprint and change things. So I see things changing. They're changing too slowly, but nonetheless, they're changing. So a moment of gratitude to you guys for really kind of taking us under your wings, and you know, being the trustworthy, you know, just hearing us and understanding our worlds, and using your talents to help our families. That's a really big deal to us. So I have a few more mom-specific questions. So is it normal to observe OCD alongside ASD? But is it common for OCD to kind of wax and wane with ASD?
So yeah, it's very common to have this rigidity because it's ASD is known for having, you know, inflexibility and rigidity, stereotypical behavior. So it's hard to kind of, you know, these stereotypical behaviors to me are kind of like an OCD, you know, there's something repetitive about them. Mm-hmm. So yes, there is, it's kind of a core issue for autism. Mm-hmm. And so again, these acute changes in that baseline OCD where it just goes to another level, then we worry about the PANS. But there are little subtle changes that can happen. You know, my OCD changes from Barney to something else, Thomas. It's still OCD. It may have changed, but, you know, the core is, you know, the OCD. So it doesn't really fluctuate that much in my experience with autism. I mean, I have some patients and now, like, I've been doing this 30 years almost. So I have patients and they're almost in their 30s that I've seen since they were two. And I think some of the core pieces for autism is this low level anxiety or, you know, a lot of anxiety and OCD, in addition to some of the, you know, social and the language deficits. But for me, if I had to pick my two most difficult symptoms, it would be OCD and anxiety.
Yeah. They're tough.
Hardest ones to crack.
Yeah.
The hardest ones to crack.
And then what about, can ASD symptoms improve on anti-inflammatories?
Yes. Which so this whole concept. Yeah. So, but they won't probably improve that much.
Yeah. Right. I've given kids
ibuprofen and they're like a new kid. That's different than I give a kid ibuprofen and they have a little bit better focus or a little bit better attention.
Yeah. Yeah. I it's one of those things that I sort of use as like a helpful little indicator for parents to try and figure out. I'm like, how does your kid do on antibiotics and anti-inflammatories and specifically ibuprofen? And, you know, I agree, like autism symptoms can improve because, you know, most of us have like some amount of inflammation. So most of us feel a little bit better if we take ibuprofen mm-hmm. or like feel somewhat better. I mean, even like if I were to take ibuprofen now, I'd probably have a slightly better day because I have some inflammation because of like life. Right. Yeah, like the kids that it's like way better is I'm generally like, you're probably dealing with more PANS. If it's like you take ibuprofen and you have like a different child in front of you, or you take antibiotics and like, it's a 95% difference in how you're feeling after antibiotics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Would you agree?
Yeah. Those are big ones. The ibuprofen, the antibiotics. Also, I like to trial antihistamines because they kind of help me about learn a little bit about the mast cell piece, because I think there's a big piece to that. And it can all get a little confusing, but you know, after you've heard it a few times, there is clarity in it. There is clarity. And I think, I don't know. I always tell my moms, I mean, listen to your gut. I really feel like we have like an instinct about our kids. Mm-hmm. And there's certain things that people can tell us and anybody could tell us, the president could tell us, whatever. We won't believe them because we know in our heart that this is this. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that mom should negate it. I know they're trying to make everybody else happy, but I really want them to listen to themselves.
Yeah. And I know that there's plenty of moms who also feel like they are so tapped out and stressed out from the demands of just regular parenting, but the demands of parenting a kid who's on the spectrum and or has PANS and PANDAS. Like, you can get so tapped out that like it can be hard to differentiate between fear and the mama gut, right? And so any little thing that we can give to help direct it, like, okay, this is what my mama gut is saying, and this other little bit of information can help me say, okay, yes, this is probably correct versus like,
yeah.
This
and
is
I
fear.
Think a lot of the moms, that's why they listen to podcasts or go to conferences and talk to different people and have their tribe or their community so that they can kind of affirm that, that, you know, affirm that feeling. It is hard. I see a lot of fear. I see a lot of fear, and I see a lot of anxiety and even OCD in the parents and, you know, kind of getting so stuck themselves or getting so fixated. And it's very difficult to manage it all.
Well, we are so grateful that you were willing to come and share your expertise with all of your experience and your wisdom from both the medical and the mom perspective. You really are, what was it, Doc Mama?
Doc Mama.
So it really is so great that you were here, because I'm sure that you gave some really useful information to help people connect with that intuition that they have in a way that they can feel more certainty with. So I love that that's where we ended. So thank you so much for your time and your generosity and your expertise today. Is there any way that people should look for you if they want to learn more about you or connect with you? Are you on social anywhere?
Yeah, I'm on Facebook, Doc Usman Singh. I'm also I have a website for the medical center, True Health Medical Center, and a website for the compounding pharmacy, Pure Compounding Pharmacy, and a website for the supplements, True Healing Naturals. So, and if you have questions, I mean, if you contact my office, I'm happy to respond.
Well, we'll make sure we put links to all of those in our show notes so people can connect with you if they want to learn more about you or have questions for you or think that you might be somebody that could help them sort out the stuff that they're dealing with your expertise. So we'll make sure everybody has the ability to connect with you. Thank you so much again for your generosity.
Well, of course. Thank you guys. And thank everybody for listening. I appreciate it a lot.
All right. Take care, everybody.
We hope you found this episode helpful, hopeful, and inspiring. We try to get a new episode out every week. You can make sure you don't miss any by following us on Spotify or subscribing to our channel on YouTube. If you want to connect with us more, join our Facebook group, Homeopathy for Pans and Pandas, where we have exclusive weekly videos and answer your questions about, you guessed it, homeopathy for pans and pandas throughout the week. If you are already a member, give us a shout out and let us know what you thought about this episode. If you aren't on Facebook and would like to reach us, you can email us at podcast@resiliencenaturopathic.com. Until next time, take care and remember, this won't be forever.